You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 241 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. I was a little bit late getting here today, and virtually. I was watching The Snowman with the children.
Oh, there you go. That was a Valley View Elementary School classic.
Oh, stone cold classic. You know, a middleist fantasy genius, baby or fantasy genius, watched it virtually in a class this year. And I was like, you watched this whole thing? And he was like, yes. And I was like, I don't think you did. And he only watched half of it. So, yeah.
How long is it?
It's 25 minutes.
Oh, okay.
He didn't know the depressing conclusion. That's that everything in life is impermanent.
Well, also, you know, you got to learn that at some point.
Yeah.
And why not age six?
It was important for this animated whimsical snowman movie to teach him that. And I think that's a really good theme for the Festivus episode of the Pelton Cast.
I guess so. It is, of course, the Festivus episode. We are recording 2 days ahead of Festivus. This pod will come out on Festivus Eve, as we all know. And we are drinking this week. There's only one choice.
You have a different package. I do.
When I went to Total Wine to get these, they had one bottle and one 22-ounce bottle and one 16-ounce tall boy can. So I assigned myself the tall boy can and assigned you the 22-ounce. We're not having a repeat of 2 weeks ago. This is, of course, from our friends at Black Raven Brewing Company in Woodinville, Washington, the Festivus Holiday Pale Ale Limited Edition, brewed with orange peels, Northwest cranberries, galangal root, and a melange of festive spices. I think I've probably made a reference about the term melange every year when we drink this on around Festivus.
Well, instead of a lot of problems with you people, we actually have a lot of toasts to get to this week.
A shocking number of toasts and a shocking number of Pro Bowlers for the Seahawks. But first, on the Seahawks, they clinched a playoff berth with Sunday's thrilling win over Washington football team. It's the ninth playoff appearance in 11 years in the Pete Carroll era.
And it's incredible how much we take this shit for granted going to the playoffs. But seeing Jamal Adams and the excitement that he had is hell yeah about going to the playoffs is really thrilling. And seeing so many games that happen every single weekend where it's just like, I don't care. Nobody cares. You know, two teams that are out of the playoffs playing each other. And the Seahawks have not had to do that at any time in Pete Carroll's tenure. And that's a thrilling thing. Even the years that they've missed the playoffs, they've been in it down to the end. And there's really nothing more that we could ask for. I think that, you know, we should count our blessings every once in a while here. This is an anti-Festivus toast. Count our blessings every once in a while that we all have been in the situation that we've been at the very least in the mix for a decade. It is a unique thing in American football.
Look, we're going to air some grievances about the Seahawks and Peter Clay Carroll a little later in this pod, but let's start by, as you said, acknowledging how great this is. I went yesterday on the Out West pod with the listener Daniel Sally and Noah Gomes, and was saying to them that because they're much younger, they can't really appreciate this because they didn't grow up in the 90s.
I heard you were only talking about basketball. That's why I wasn't there.
Well, it was like at the very
beginning. You talked about football too?
Yeah, at the very beginning we did. It was primarily an NBA season.
Did you give your top 10 songs of the year? So help me God.
I think that did come up at the end of the pod, but fortunately I could barely remember any of them for some reason on the spot. It was very odd. I couldn't even remember Harry Styles' name, and he appears twice in my top five.
I talked about current trends in booking and management.
Live podcast space. Up-and-coming young bands. No, I don't know that they really appreciate it because, you know, my experience,
aren't these Mariners fans, though?
That's true. They can't understand it from that standpoint, but not from the Seahawks standpoint where, you know, I started following the Seahawks probably in 93. Like I can vaguely remember some Seahawks games before that. And it wasn't until 1999 that they actually made the playoffs. So I'm used to long playoff droughts, not sustained playoff runs.
I mean, I don't know if used to is really the way to put it, because we have spent the better part of two decades as being quite successful as the Seahawks, which has been, you know, it's an incredible thing. And again, we should be very thankful for this. Making the playoffs is, you know, we've talked about this year after year. The goals are, and who knows which of these goals we'll discuss later, but the goals are always first, make the playoffs. Make the playoffs, win the division, get a bye, get the number one seed. Obviously, those things are a little bit different here in 2020, and the get a bye is not really a factor, but they've achieved goal number one. Well, get a bye and get the number one seed are the same thing.
Gotcha. I see what you're saying. Yes, yes. They've reduced the number there. Well, that success for the Seahawks was also rewarded at the individual level, where on Monday, seven Seahawks were named to the Pro Bowl. Obviously, Russell Wilson at quarterback, DK Metcalf getting his first nod at wide receiver.
Can we just, before you name these players, if you would have asked me, this actually would have been a fun exercise. If you would have been like, seven Seahawks have been named to the Pro Bowl, can you name them? I think I'm getting three.
I had seen previously, I guess I'm getting four.
I think I would have confidently gotten four.
I had seen previously that Nick Ballor was leading the voting. I thought it was at fullback. I didn't realize that it was at the special teams position. And I was like, really? Nick Ballor at fullback? But special teams makes a bit more sense for him.
Okay, anyway.
So two special teams Pro Bowlers for the Seahawks. Both Nick Ballor is the special teams specialist and Tyler Ott is the long snapper. I don't know how you determine the Pro Bowl long snapper, but the snaps have been good.
The Seahawks special teams have been very good this year. It is kind of funny to see the long snapper and a special teamer, but neither of the specialists make the Pro Bowl, who've both had amazing seasons. I mean, you know, I think Younghoe Koo, you have to give it up to, as having, seeing the stats apples to apples, Jason Myers versus Younghoe Koo, because you look at it and you're like, what the hell else could Jason Myers do? But, you know, Koo has a little bit more on his resume, and that makes sense to me if you're only going to choose one kicker. But Dixon has had a great year, and I think it's almost like the long snapper Pro Bowl nod for Tyler Ott is like, it's like a half nod for Dixon.
I would agree with that, or for Myers for that matter. And then from the defense, the Seahawks have three special teamers on defense. Presumably the two that you were going to guess were Bobby Wagner and Jamal Adams. Seemed very likely. But also Quandre Diggs, I think, a bit of a surprise.
Oh, I mean, I freaking love Quandre Diggs. And I think he's had a very nice season. I don't know if at any point I would have said to myself, that has been a Pro Bowl season. And maybe that's something to the state of safeties in the NFC at this point. But it's an amazing thing to see. You know, especially that the Seahawks have gone out, maybe this is more of a question mark, have gone out and traded for in consecutive years at the safety position Pro Bowlers.
That is quite interesting. All right, and next toast to Megan Rapinoe, who was named to the FIFA Pro Women's Best 11, which was for 2020, which is surprising in as much as Rapinoe did not play a competitive match after the COVID-19 pandemic shut down sports in March. She spent way more time in the wubble than she did on the soccer pitch.
You know what? I'm all for it. That's the thing. It's like, it's the Megan Rapinoe FIFA 11, right? It's her award.
And the award voted on by FIFA Pro members, i.e. other players.
You know, Megan Rapinoe gets that because of the respect that she's earned as a soccer player and as a personality. And it wouldn't be the same without Megan Rapinoe on it.
In her basically thank you post on Twitter, Rapinoe highlighted, we have so many phenomenal female players around the world, and all of us need to do what we can to recognize them. The fact that I was selected once again sheds light on the fact that in order to push our game forward, we need continued investment in the women's game to give more female players the opportunity to be seen on TV in their home countries and globally while performing for club and country.
I think that's partially true, and I think that that's partially untrue, because a lot of these awards are just popularity contests. I mean, that's why it was surprising to see Quandre Diggs get nominated to the Pro Bowl, because he's not a big-name player, whereas, you know, if it's an offensive lineman or whatever, a lot of positions, it's just like, yeah, whatever. Who have I heard of here? And I think it's like that with a lot of these awards.
It's like the year where Rafael Palmeiro won a gold glove, and I think he played like 25 games at first base. Is my vague recollection of this? I think this is a thing that happened.
It's partially owing to that nobody is paying attention to anything that closely.
28 games at first base the year he won a gold glove in 1999 while playing for the Rangers. All right, lastly, on a more somber note, we're remembering former Sonic Bruce Seals, who died Tuesday at age 67 after battling cancer. After two seasons in the ABA, Seals joined the Sonics in 1975-76, reuniting with his former Xavier Loyola University teammate Slick Watts, and was fifth on the team in scoring at 11.8 points per game, was part of the team through 1977-78 when the Sonics reached the NBA Finals and lost in seven games to the Washington Bullets. After a contract dispute, Seals went to Europe and never returned to the NBA, but something I did not realize, sadly, until he passed away, had quite an interesting life. He later spent three decades as the athletic director at the Boys and Girls Club of Dorchester and served as an assistant coach at Emerson University, where one of the players on the team was Sam Presti.
Wow, look at that. There were two players on the Sonics championship team from Xavier Loyola.
Not on the champion. Neither of them were on the championship team. They were both on the team that went to the finals, but Slick Watts was traded midway through that season. And part of the reason for that is assistant coach Bruce Hopkins, who coached the team at the start of that 77-78 season, was also the coach there previously.
So is this a college or a high school?
College.
Xavier Loyola? This is not Xavier, and this is not Loyola.
I may be screwing up the name of the university. Yeah, Xavier of Louisiana.
Totally different college from Xavier. This is not the Musketeers.
This is correct, yes. They are in Ohio.
Okay.
So.
Basketball was different then.
Well, a lot of things were different then. I don't know if you're aware of this. Black players didn't necessarily have the opportunity to play everywhere in the early 1970s in the way that they do now. It was kind of an issue back then. So, anyways, a really fascinating life for him. I also thought it was interesting that his family came up here, and his niece, Joy Hollingsworth, was a star at Seattle Prep High School, who later played at Arizona and was an assistant coach at Seattle U for a while before quitting to go into the cannabis business. So,
I drove by the way, have you been past Sean Kemp Cannabis?
I have not been to Queen Anne in a long time.
I'm pretty skeptical about the business relationship between them, and how beneficial it is for Sean Kemp, but it's a beautiful place. I mean,
the mural looks great.
Oh, seeing Sean Kemp on the side of a building, it makes you want to go inside of that building.
That's accurate. Yes. That's all you had to say on it?
I mean, I drove by. It's very, very close to my office.
Well, it's very, very close to where your office used to be.
Since yeah, hypothetical office.
May never be.
It's not near my basement.
So, by the way, to correct that, it's Bob Hopkins, who was the head coach of the Sonics after Bill Russell, not Bruce.
You'll correct another. You'll say, to correct that, it's former Husky head coach Mike Hopkins.
Oh, no. It's that bad? Might be that bad. All right, we don't have a full Seattle food update this week, but I did want to highlight some sad news that I came across last week, which is that it appears that Five Spot, a fixture on the top of Queen Anne Hill and a spot I frequented while working for the Storm in Inner Bay, is no more. Can't find anything definitive, but Five Spot never reopened after the closure in March and quietly disappeared from the website of parent group Chow Foods.
Wow.
I know this doesn't mean much to you as a notorious, inexplicable Five Spot hater.
I've literally never been there. I'm not a hater of it. I'm ignorant to it at the most.
You have, I mean, you worked at two different locations in Queen Anne, granted in lower Queen Anne. You had to work hard never to go to the Five Spot.
You don't go up the retrograde. Like wherever that grade is, you know, we're on the lower half of it.
There was a previous episode of this podcast where we talked about the trolley or whatever that used to go up Queen Anne Hill and all of that process, and that was complete news to you.
Never been on it.
Moving along, for the first time in a while, now I guess we had one the last couple of weeks, we've got a more extensive NBA Seattle update sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Wow. All right, because Pagliacci Pizza is back in the game, and so is basketball in Seattle. And I have to say, if basketball were to ever come back to Seattle, I think we have to thank Pagliacci Pizza for it.
They've certainly been keeping it in the public eye. Some interesting news Monday is Adam Silver slightly softened his tone on possible expansion in his preseason national media address. Asked by my ESPN colleague Tim Bontemps this question: the NBA in recent months has worked to get revenue for teams, given everything that's going on in the pandemic, and as you've alluded to earlier, the revenue you guys have lost from lack of fans at games, etc. With that in mind, has there been any change to the league's position on the possibility of an expansion? And if not, what would it take for that position to change? So Silver's response: there hasn't been a change in the league's position. I think I've always said that it's sort of the manifest destiny of the league that you expand at some point. I'd say it caused us to maybe dust off some of the analyses on the economic and competitive impacts of expansion. We've been putting a little bit more time into it than we were pre-pandemic, but certainly not to the point that expansion is on the front burner.
I don't know if that, I was so ready for a hello. It doesn't quite warrant a hello, but I, you know,
does it warrant a hello?
Possibly. We'll see. If it's not on the front burner, that means that it's probably not happening anytime soon. But I do think a pandemic is a scenario where you look around and you say, where can we get a free $2 billion? And, you know, expansion is one of those places. Also, you look around and you say, you know what, our business is, I don't want to say crumbling, but is severely affected. And you say to yourself, what is the one thing that has held steady through this? Is it ticket sales? Is it fandom? It is TV money. And they had a hard time getting viewers in the bubble NBA finals with some pretty major market teams that were playing in it. And, you know, granted, Miami is not the biggest market in the world, but, you know, I think the Heat in general are a pretty big market Eastern team at the very least. And they're playing against the Lakers, which is the biggest team. And they still had a hard time attracting fans. So if you're looking at it and you're like, well, if that's the case and we have these markets that are sitting out there, you know, even you've got Sacramento, you've got Oklahoma City, you've got teams in small places, you know, maybe you want to rethink the entire structure of the league and say, hey, maybe we'd like to have some fans in some bigger markets at some point.
Well, that's always been kind of the issue with expansion is if you're a team in the number 12 market, you're like, why are we expanding and giving up more of our TV money when we could, and revenue sharing to these smaller markets, when we could just move a team from one of those markets and put them in a bigger market?
Do it. I dare you. This is the move a team from Oklahoma City to a bigger market challenge, NBA owners. Like, you can look at it that way, but the reality is it's not going to happen. You already fucked it up. You fucked it up one time because you wanted to heist cities for arenas, and you made a choice in the mid-2000s. That choice proved to be wrong, and you can't undo it at this point. But
I think the NBA would say, we got an arena done in Sacramento, we got an arena done in Milwaukee, and we did that because of what happened in Seattle.
Slow clap for them having arenas in small cities. You really held these small cities hostage.
Milwaukee is not a small city.
It's still not a, you know, this is not New York or LA here. Like, they have a team in Milwaukee. But, look, I love Milwaukee. But this is not... it's still not Seattle, right? And the entire point of the standoff was they wanted cities to pay for arenas. And the city of Seattle did probably long-term what was right and held strong against this perspective and didn't have to pay for an arena. And the reality is the NBA is in a worse position right now than the city of Seattle is.
I don't agree with that whatsoever.
Are people still moving to the city of Seattle? Are housing prices the same in the city of Seattle? Are businesses coming to the city of Seattle? Like, what are you telling me? Look, the city of Seattle is very bad because it has an inept mayor. But, like, it has nothing to do with not having a professional basketball team.
But the people of Seattle would like a basketball team more than the NBA would like to be in Seattle. Otherwise, the NBA would be in Seattle.
I don't know if that's true. So, but the point is, they looked around and they said to themselves, our whole business is set up wrong. We've bet on the wrong horses.
And no, they did not. No, none of this happened.
That's what Adam Silver was saying happened, right?
How because much of that beer did you drink already?
They were very happy with how things looked. Look, this is a righteous response. They looked around and they were happy with how things looked before, right? When everything was coming in, everything was glorious. But then when anything was shaken, they said to themselves, you know what? Maybe we would like to be in the 12th best media market in the goddamn country.
I mean, I don't even know that we should take this as Seattle-specific news necessarily. It's not like Seattle is the only city in the country that is capable of hosting an NBA team, or even outside of the country. Mexico City, I don't think, probably is capable of doing it right now, you know, before a G League franchise has gone there.
I don't think there are that many people in Louisville ready to fork up $2 billion for an NBA team.
I think you could figure it out. There are more people who want to own NBA teams than there are NBA teams. And that's why the NBA is in a favorable position, no matter what you're arguing.
Hurry up and do it. Hurry up and do it, Adam Silver. Like, come on. What are we waiting for? There's been no news for so many years on this issue. And we're at the point where the whole league has been shaken.
Again, you keep saying shaken. What? First off, everything has been shaken because the entire economic model of the world collapsed overnight. So that's, you know, like, sorry, the NBA didn't see that coming.
They have a unique opportunity to restructure what they're doing.
What does this even mean, restructure what they're doing? Like,
value having teams in larger media markets.
Okay, well, if you're valuing having teams in larger media markets, you're moving a second team to Chicago. That's what you're doing.
Fucking do both, right? They have to. How many teams are in the league? 30 right now? You got to even it out. You don't want 31 teams in your league. Put a second team in Chicago.
They're not going to put a second team in Chicago. But that would be a much bigger deal from a media market standpoint. Seattle is not that valuable a media market.
It is the most valuable media market that the NBA is not currently in.
For sure. And it is probably the most valuable. I'd have to look this up, but it might be the most valuable media market that any of the big four sports is not in. So
then what?
But that's not a restructuring of the league.
It is.
I don't even know what that means.
The general goal under the David Stern regime agree with this?
I don't think it has changed that dramatically. I think they're considering expansion.
There was a priority to get arenas from cities. To get publicly funded arenas. That was a priority of theirs. And I think the priority has changed over time. I'm saying.
It's not like there wasn't privately funded. There weren't privately funded arenas previous to the Sonics move. You know, Pepsi Center, now Ball Arena in Denver, was privately funded with Tim Leiwicki building it, oddly, and building the Staples Center in LA. Oddly, he was involved in a lot of the public or the private arenas that were done in this time. But there was an emphasis on this. And I think Seattle was like the right size market that was big enough where it was like, well, we can take your team. Don't feel like, you know, you're just guaranteed to have a team, but not a New York or LA where you couldn't actually have a team.
I mean, the NFL didn't have a team in LA for decades.
And look at how great it's done since it went
there. Oh,
well, we'll talk more about that later. For now, though, it's time to get into maybe our favorite annual tradition.
Hello. Well, just first off on that, Adam Silver, let's go. We're ready. Let's fucking go. The city of Seattle is ready for a basketball team. There are buyers. There's an arena. There is literally nothing stopping you.
What's stopping you is not wanting to divide up the national TV pie 32 ways instead of 30. That's what's stopping them. That's not a small thing. I mean, you just explained it, that the TV money is the one constant. So the more you split that up, the less valuable it is to each individual owner. But in a situation where those individual owners can't necessarily realize the appreciation of their franchise values and don't have as much income coming in the short term, then expansion can be a way to make that up.
Mm-hmm. I heard that they're all going broke. that let's go could mean more than just getting arena done, but or getting expansion done. But if there are teams that you want to move, now is the time to have that conversation.
That's a difficult conversation to have. Can we talk about our 10 players to watch?
That's the thing. That's what I'm telling you. We are in the city of Seattle. We should have a team, these 10 players to watch. One of them, there should be a stashed European player that we are paying attention to in the city of Seattle for the season. But basketball is starting today, and I have almost no rooting interest.
Wow. What happened to our Blazers?
But I feel nothing. I was thinking about Christmas Day, and I was like, wow, stacked schedule of NBA games. But I'll be watching the Vikings and the Saints? Is that who's playing?
They are the game on Christmas Day, yes.
That's the game that I care about, because that's the game that matters to me personally. I don't care about what's happening in the NBA. Come on.
But here's the 10 players you should care about this season. We start with... of course, an international rookie, Denny Avdija of the Washington Wizards.
Can we introduce this list here before you get into this? Okay, so this is an annual list that we do. Which
correct.
We've
done it, I think, for 6 years running.
Highlighting players. These are not your Obi Toppins. These are not your LaMelo Balls. These are not players who, you know, have gotten a lot of attention going into the NBA season. These are some underground players. As much as an NBA player can be underground, these are the players who would end up being breakouts, you know, and players to pay attention to for this NBA season. Some of them have ended up being pretty big stars, and some of them have ended up basically never playing in the NBA.
Correct. Some of the standouts from past lists include Nikola Jokic, of course, in 2015, and Pascal Siakam, I did not realize was on this list when he was a rookie in 2016. Last year, you lamented that it was the most obscure list ever. You went 0-10 when we did the who he play for on this. But still, even though there were some definite non-factors among this list, it included Alex Caruso, NBA champion, breakout star Christian Wood, who then got a bunch of money from the Houston Rockets, and Kendrick Nunn, who was a starter for the Miami Heat all season.
So. All right. Taking a little victory lap on knowing about the NBA. Nice.
Look.
This is like your, when I did the list on the music episode of the up and coming artists, this is your version of that though.
And, 100%.
You know, it's a little bit different circumstances. It's a little bit later in the year that we're doing this. But I'm excited to learn about the next Eastern European star.
All right, so we start off with one possible contender. In FIBA terms, Israel is in Europe. Obviously, in geographic terms, it's not. But Denny Avdija of the Washington Wizards, who was a lottery pick this year.
Was from Israel, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just said that. Yeah. It looks like he's going to start for the Wizards right away. Wow. He's been starting for them during the preseason. He's shot the ball quite well. That's kind of the big question. He's a really good playmaker for his size, a surprisingly good defender for his size. I would say, like, if everything goes right for Denny Avdija, Tony Kukoc is sort of his best case outcome.
Okay.
Which would be fun. All right. Is previewed last week on the pod. The obligatory European member of the Denver Nuggets. It was not actually European, which is the fun fact about this. Facundo Campazzo, Argentine point guard, who is extremely short. He's listed at 5'11". He looks even shorter than that, but makes incredible highlight reel passes. Already had some that were trendy on Twitter during the preseason. I don't know how much he's going to play because they have passed player to watch Monte Morris at backup point guard behind Jamal Murray, but they may play those guys together somewhat. We saw them do that in the preseason. So anytime he gets out there, that's going to be a league pass must watch.
Wow, Facundo Campazzo.
Yes.
All right. Where did Facundo Campazzo come from?
He was playing in Spain previously.
How did the Nuggets get
his
rights?
He's just a free agent. He's like 28.
Okay.
So he literally played a game 1 week. I can't remember whether he was at Madrid or Barcelona. He was on one of the two Spanish powers. He played a game 1 week and then signed with the Nuggets the next, which was kind of wild. I didn't realize that. Like, Denny played over the summer, but he wasn't playing the start of this season. All right, next up, my favorite player in this year's draft, Tyrese Haliburton of the Sacramento Kings.
We knew he would be on there.
Yeah, he was kind of inevitable. He's already stuffing the stat sheet.
He's almost a little too obvious for this list, but yes.
I went a little less obscure this year. There's only a couple guys that are really, really obscure. Already in his second preseason game against the Blazers, he had like the ultimate Tyrese Haliburton stat line that I need to go dig up my tweet so that I can list off what it was here. All right, 30 minutes, 5 of 10 from the field, 6 rebounds, 7 assists, 1 steal, 1 block, 11 points, no turnovers, plus 20.
Steal the draft, as far as you're concerned.
100%. The other option candidate will be up later on the list. All right, next up, from the Detroit Pistons, Killian Hayes, another top 10 pick this year, international, a Frenchman who played last season in Germany, and it looks like he's going to start at point guard for them. So he's probably going to turn the ball over a ton. He had a real problem with that in Germany, but he's got promise down the road. All right, next up, my actual favorite player on this list.
Wow. More than
Haliburton. I have described this player as, if you took my game relative to the level of competition I played against back when I played pickup basketball and translated it to the NBA, the closest possible comparison in NBA history for that would be John Conchar of the Memphis Grizzlies.
This is more than Reggie Evans.
Well, because Reggie Evans is actually 6'8". Like, it makes sense that he would play the way he does. But John Conchar is 6'5". He shot some threes during the preseason, but he doesn't shoot threes well. He gets a ton of offensive rebounds. He just like makes random plays. He seems like he has no business in the NBA. I remember talking about him with a friend of mine who used to work in the NBA during the summer league in 2019 when the Grizzlies had just signed him to 2-way after he went undrafted. And this person scoffed at his ability. Like, it was shocking to him that he would even be on a 2-way contract.
Wow.
And yet the Grizzlies liked him so much they re-signed him to a 4-year deal this year.
Wow.
So, out of Indiana, Purdue, Fort Wayne.
Oh, not even IUPUI.
No, not like George Hill. IPFW. The Mastodons. That would be the Biggie Fantasy Genius favorite back in the day. So you're definitely going to want to check out John Conchar if the Grizzlies are on national TV at some point, which they probably are.
This is a little bit too national, but is Ja Morant going to be MVP candidate this year?
I mean, he was really high in my preseason warp statistics, but no, I don't think he's going to be that good.
You're not as high on Ja yet.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to take a few years.
Okay.
All right. Next up, a 2019 first round pick who did not play last year because he had a torn ACL that he suffered in the NCAA tournament that year while helping Auburn. They eventually got to the Final Four without him. That's Chuma Okeke of the Orlando Magic. Another player who is a favorite of my statistical projections. You know, he's kind of a solid 3-and-D role player who, will get some minutes for them off the bench. All right, next up, maybe other than Campazzo, the most obvious selection on this list. I don't know how much he's going to play this season, but that's Alexei Pokusevski of the Oklahoma City Thunder. So this guy was playing in the Greek second division. I went and checked out his film before the draft on Synergy. He was the most useless film I've ever watched on a prospect because he's like the tallest player on the court by 5 inches. He's way more athletic than everyone else. And he's just coming down and jacking up threes. It's like the most talented player who doesn't care in a pickup game who's way below their level. It was so fun to watch. So he is pretty much still playing that same style for Oklahoma City. I don't know, again, how much he's going to play, but anytime he does.
The level of competition has increased a bit, though.
Just a tad. All right, next up on our list.
Is it the first ever Oklahoma City player you've included?
I don't have the 2018 list, but I have not in the list that I have come up. No, Alex Abrines, when he came over, was for the Thunder representative. All right, next up, someone who suffered an torn ACL last year while playing in the G League Showcase on a two-way contract for the Chicago Bulls is back now, made the Miami Heat as a two-way player out of training camp. Max Strus, from someone I've enjoyed watching dating back to his DePaul days, a really high flyer who also shoots a lot of threes. He's kind of like, if you were making the best possible version of Max Strus, he would basically be Dan Majerle.
Wow, Max Strus. I mean, you got to love an obscure player for the Heat, because I feel like they always end up being good.
Exactly, yeah. Colleger mentioned the other day in his Heat preview that, you know, he could be the next Duncan Robinson, which I don't know if I'm that optimistic, but that's what they're hoping. All right, next up from the Houston Rockets, another international player coming over to the NBA for the first time. Well, I mean, he's an American player who played overseas. Jayshon Tate, who was a star in Australia after playing at Ohio State. He's kind of like their attempt to create a new PJ Tucker. He doesn't really shoot threes yet, but he's like 6'5" and plays power forward and center. So,
and Ohio State and then went to play basketball in Australia.
Yeah. I mean, they're good players in Australia.
No, I'm just trying to understand the trajectory. This was no shade to Australia. Look, fucking love Australia.
A toast to Australia.
Let it be known. I've got a Courtney Barnett record right there.
Basically, if you're a 6'5" power forward, you're going to end up on this list. That's another rule of thumb.
You're going to end up both on this list and on Daryl Morey's list. Obviously not for this year's Houston Rockets, but
I would assume that Daryl, they had some planning on this one ahead of time before when Daryl was there, I think.
He was a target.
Like, everyone knew that he was going to sign with the Rockets way before free agency. Clearly, weirdly, they didn't get charged for tampering for that, though. Lastly, my other candidate for steal of the draft from the San Antonio Spurs, taking one pick ahead of Haliburton, Devin Vassell from Florida State.
This is like, what pick was he in the draft? Pretty high.
11.
Never heard of this person.
Yeah, well, he did not have a real high Q rating at Florida State, I wouldn't say.
I mean, this draft, maybe, I don't, you tell me if this was more so than ever, but like, looking around at these draft picks, I'm just like,
well, because like almost none of them made the NCAA tournament or would have made the NCAA tournament. And then even the guys who would have made it.
Tell me about this NCAA tournament. Yes.
I know Dickie V wrote a book with an imaginary outcome from it. But like even the guys on good teams like Vassell, like ordinarily, if they got to the Elite Eight, you would have seen at least one Florida State game and learned who he was. But that didn't happen. So you never got to find out about him.
Counterpoint, I wouldn't have.
He basically plays a lot like Danny Green, and he's going to the Spurs, so obviously he's going to do very well. They're going to develop him perfectly. He actually was he was the best rookie in terms of wins above replacement player in the preseason.
Really? But
I don't know if he's going to play as much in the regular season, because they had a couple of guys. Keldon Johnson was hurt, and I think someone else who was going to be in the rotation ahead of him was hurt in the preseason. So he probably won't play that much this year, but definitely keep an eye on him if he does.
Yeah, you got to clear out for Keldon Johnson.
He played quite well in the bubble. So that's the list.
All right.
And I look forward to you not paying any attention to these players whatsoever and being surprised when I mentioned last year that some breakout star was on this list. When Max Strus wins Most Improved Player, you heard it first.
Yeah, can't wait. Is there anything else that we should be paying attention to going into this NBA season? Again, starting tonight, you've already thrown your shade at the Blazers. We've heard it. But still a very deep Western Conference. You have Phoenix looking like a probable playoff team.
I think so. This is assuming they stay reasonably healthy.
I mean, it feels like that sort of second tier of the Western Conference, all of them got better, which is kind of the case almost always in the Western Conference, it feels like. New Orleans, I would assume, is going to improve.
They'll probably improve just because Zion's healthier. I didn't like their offseason at all. I didn't like their offseason that much, I guess.
They're going to have a full season of Zion, a second season of Zion, and it's just it's a different world. Sacramento is probably improved. Basically, a lot of those teams that are on the fridge, Haliburton's not important enough to you?
They've upgraded their bench. Hassan Whiteside at the minimum was an incredible steal, but they did lose Bogdan Bogdanovic and not get anything in return. So
Whiteside at the minimum, wow.
Yeah. Like, we, I knew the NBA hated Hassan Whiteside. I didn't realize the NBA hated Hassan Whiteside that much.
Wow. But yeah, I mean,
and Houston is the team that is probably going to fall out of that when they trade James Harden. So,
are you breaking news right here on the Pelton Cast?
No, I have no inside info, but they're going to trade James Harden at some point. So then Christian Wood takes over as their star player.
Uh-huh.
My most improved player
and
award.
All
pick
of
this
their
year.
Draft picks go to the Thunder.
Just the significant majority of them.
Okay. Well,
that would be a good time for the Andy Samberg. Cool, cool, cool. Cool.
Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, well, I'm excited to sort of pay attention to this NBA season.
Yeah, apparently not pay attention to this NBA season.
No, I'm frustrated.
Well, on the expansion front, we got some news on the Seattle Kraken expansion draft, which according to Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic, was set for Wednesday, July 21st. Mark your calendars.
Hello!
Precisely 7 months away as we record this podcast.
That
on
gets a
solstice.
Hello. Oh, from one solstice to another. That's actually after the solstice.
June 21st.
I'm going to stick with it. From one solstice to another. The shortest day of the year to the longest. You said June 21st, right? To the longest day of the year, from a cold, dark place to new beginnings. And I'm sure we'll have an NBA expansion franchise announced by then. And I'm sure we'll have heard of any of the players that are taken in this NHL expansion draft.
There might be like a couple of players.
Oh,
I know.
Look, if a Sedin or Roberto Luongo get drafted, sign me up.
Oh, that one glorious Canucks run to the Stanley Cup Finals that we got really into. Good times. Now there are our hated rival Canucks. NHL draft will take place 2 days later on July 23rd with NHL free agency set to begin July 28th.
Great.
So there you go. It's coming up. You'll be here before you know it. On the Sounders front, more positive signs for an extension for manager Brian Schmetzer, who told KJR last week, if I was a betting man, yeah, something gets done. So much, much more positive tone on that front.
Okay. Kind of a weird question to ask a person.
I don't know if they asked him directly that. I think that was just his response to a different question or a question phrased differently.
They asked him a different question and he said, if I were a betting man, something gets done with regards to the contract?
No, I think it probably asked
what
him like,
other
hey, so
question
what's...
could you have reasonably answered that to?
I think they probably asked him like, so hey, what's going on with your contract negotiations? And that was his expression.
It's kind of like, you remember Jalen Ramsey this summer on Hard Knocks when people kept asking about his contract? It's like, I feel like this business is, especially for an athlete themselves, it's just like, talk to my agent.
I get why Jalen Ramsey was so frustrated. I think Brian Schmetzer is probably more interested in negotiating in the media than Jalen Ramsey was.
Okay.
Given his popularity here. And, you know, I think Jalen Ramsey knew that deal was getting done. Schmetz probably does at this point, too. But
oh, yeah. Look, I would have stormed out of Zoom, too. I storm out of almost every Zoom that I'm on.
I mean, you'd storm out of most Pelton casts. I just edit that out.
Yeah.
One of Schmetz's assistants, Gonzalo Pineda, former Sounders player, interviewed last week for the DC United head coach job. So, chance there will be a Schmetz coaching tree in MLS.
All right.
Now some surprising news on the OL Reign front that we need to get into. In an interview with French newspaper Le Monde, OL Reign part owner Tony Parker, yes, that Tony Parker, mentioned his intent to move the Reign to Miami. Jeff Kasouf of Equalizer Soccer reported that OL Group, the owners of the Reign, initially targeted Miami for a possible expansion franchise before purchasing the Reign. The interview in Le Monde was subsequently edited to change Parker's quote from using the collective noun nous or we to je or I, making it strictly about Parker's desire rather than OL Group.
But wait, what was the quote? That's not...
It was, we intend to move the team to Miami, or to Miami.
He said new or VU. What did he say? Look, some of us took 3 years of college French here. There's no slipping one past us.
But it's important to note that Parker, even if he speaks individually, is speaking for the OL group because he's a member of their board of directors.
Yeah. Je m'appelle Tony Parker.
So OL released a statement reading in part, OL continues to believe in the Seattle-Tacoma market as it features a strong economic, cultural, and sporting environment which will support and enhance the development of OL Reign. As a result, Olympic Lyonnais has committed to make a substantial investment to develop a new training center for OL Reign in Tacoma. Additionally, OL Reign is currently engaged in negotiations to extend its lease at Cheney Stadium in Tacoma beyond the 2021 season. Furthermore, Olympic Lyonnais has committed to strengthen OL Reign's squad for the upcoming season, with two international players from OL planned to join OL Reign in 2021. Sidebar from that, rumor is that one of those will be French center back Wendy Renard, who is one of the best soccer players on the planet. So that would be very exciting. Back to the quote, OL remains committed to its original objective to own the two best women's football teams on the planet and to have one of those teams located in the Pacific Northwest. So that makes it seem like all is good. But there's this key passage elsewhere in the press release that I think we need to talk about. The choice of the Seattle-Tacoma market was heavily influenced by the opportunity to play in a new soccer-specific stadium in Tacoma, which is a necessary component for OL's plans to grow the club. The goal is to provide OL Reign with a modern venue in which to play its matches and to deliver a superior experience to OL Reign supporters who have been steadfast in their support for the club over the last 8 years. So, the plans to build a soccer-specific stadium in Tacoma for the Reign and Tacoma Defiance, the Sounders USL affiliate, are now in limbo. Back in March, those two organizations signed a non-binding letter of intent to embark on a public process for a $60 million stadium, which called for $7.5 million in funding for Metro Parks Tacoma and $15 million from the city of Tacoma. And that funding, which there hasn't really been any update on in the last like 8 months, now in jeopardy with the downturn in revenues due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So it feels like another situation where the league might be ready to say to the Seattle area, you need to pony up for a stadium or the team is moving.
So who are you cheering for? The Thorns? Portland Thorns, probably.
Our Thorns? Never.
Our Thorns. I mean, look, it was written. Like, we see what's going to happen here. Come on. There's nobody who would be so naive as to not think that Tony Parker was speaking not on behalf of the ownership group, but also not having some of the,
inside info.
No, I'm sure that Tony Parker has the inside info, but that Tony Parker doesn't have some of the maybe media training that some of the other members would have, or he's speaking a little bit more off the cuff here than some of the other owners who are trying to negotiate these deals through back channels rather than just coming out and saying it are. And look, this might have been a slip of the tongue, but I think this is a reality that we have to live with. It's like, you know, committed to staying in Tacoma past the 2021 season. This is not good for the long-term future of OL Reign in Tacoma.
It's a Kinsey gaffe. Which is where you say the truth on and when you're not supposed to. So,
I mean, we've been through this process. We know how this process ends, and it's not good.
Kinsley gaffe, I should clarify, by the way. I mean, now possibly something will get done in Tacoma. The Defiance still need a home. This is some, you know, a process that was in.
Frank Chop's a reasonable dude.
Free Chop's not there anymore. It also does not involve the state legislature. But the question is,
negotiate with David Stern?
Between the Rainiers, the Sounders, and the Reign, can they come up with a way to make up
some of
this public
funding?
Don't the
Rainiers have a stadium, though? Like, are the Rainiers
They are
in
involved in the ownership of the Defiance along with the Sounders.
Interesting.
Yes.
I mean, I've been to Thirsty Thursdays at Cheney Stadium.
So the team is currently playing at Cheney Stadium, but the idea is to build a soccer-specific stadium, I believe, next door to Cheney Stadium.
Yeah, what is the issue with Cheney Stadium? I mean, I suppose
Well, it's not built for soccer. It's built for baseball. That's
no,
the issue.
They should have a soccer-specific stadium. Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, if it's going to be built for the Defiance. Like, the Defiance got to play somewhere, right?
I mean, there is some reforms coming to how the MLS is handling the USL. We haven't gotten into those on the podcast. I felt that was a little too technical.
But, we're getting deeper inside baseball. We already host a podcast specific to Seattle sports and food, but... Let's get deep into the process for how the MLS is handling the USL.
It sounds like some MLS teams will be divesting of their USL affiliates in the upcoming seasons. So,
why is that? They don't have money.
I read a story,
they got
but
no
I,
money. Oh my god!
No, it's not a money thing.
Everything is a money thing, and it's a fucking house of cards, and it's all gonna collapse.
It's more about what's the best way for us to develop our players. And it might not be necessarily to have them playing for a separate USL affiliate.
Interesting.
So we'll see.
This is bad news. And on this, we have no grievances to air specifically, but if we do, you have no specific airing of grievances, right?
I don't have one scheduled. No. Are you considering whether to do an impromptu grievance against Tony Parker? I mean, look, I've always known
no,
that's just
not,
Tony Parker.
This is not
back to
personal,
the 2002.
No, this is not personal about Tony Parker. Look, Tony Parker is saying what he's saying. He's part of he's a minute part of the ownership group, but it's about the whole group in general. I mean, when
I've learned a lot about Tony Parker's relationship with OL Group, which. So there's a partnership between he owns the Asvel basketball franchise in Lyon, which Alicia Clark plays for the Storm plays for the women's team there. And the speculation is that he will eventually become the president of OL Group, that he's the heir to that position.
Yeah, so he probably doesn't know. Probably doesn't know.
Definitely out of the loop.
Yeah, to move a team.
And also, he's apparently involved in building an airport in the Miami area. There's just a lot going on with Tony Parker. He's a busy dude.
This team is gone.
It's not great. It's not great.
Wow, I thought we were going to go into this and you're going to have positive news, but you don't. This isn't even like when you were like, I met Clay Bennett. He looked in my eyes. He was a good man.
I mean, I knew as soon as Ed Evans was gone.
Oh, that's you're retronyming that or whatever.
Should we talk about a happier subject?
Oh, Husky basketball? No!
Husky sports! Oh, I gotta tell you, I think this
might have been... I got a lot of problems with you people.
I think this might have been the worst week in the history of the UW Athletic Department.
No.
I'm gonna say that.
You know what? I actually heard that they sold the whole program to Tony Parker.
Oh, no. Look, if he wants to move it to Miami to compete with the U, good luck. We start with women's basketball, which suffered a 73-49 loss Saturday versus number 7 Oregon. This actually seemed reasonably positive for a while. They played again without Tamia Sadler, who, after the team had previously said she'd be back for this game after sitting out the game against Portland that they won for rest purposes at that point. Coach Jody Wynn said after the Oregon game that Sadler would now be out indefinitely, although we still have no indication
that rest was actually COVID-19 and that there's no fucking information from any college program ever. Thank you.
What seemed
like bullshit. We heard it last week. We talked about this. It was like, you're having a rest game in college?
It did seem very suspicious, I grant.
I never once heard that.
Now, the one thing I don't know, I watched part of this game, but I don't remember seeing the bench, or I don't know whether she was on the bench. Like, if that was the case, then it's clearly an injury rather than COVID. But
the good news is we'll have no idea.
I mean, eventually we might find out.
When the book is written in 25 years?
Yeah. The Huskies trailed by just 14 entering the final quarter before Oregon pulled away. But this seemed like a positive performance against an undefeated Oregon squad until Wazoo nearly beat Oregon earlier today.
I hate the whole fucking college. Do you want to know where my diploma is? I have no idea.
I mean, I also have no idea where my diploma is. Gone. That's not something I'm that concerned about. UW's doing better than Oregon State women's basketball, which had to cancel Monday's scheduled game after a confirmed positive test for COVID-19 in the Beavers program.
for the whole team.
The fact that there was no contact tracing would would lend some credence to the idea that it is in fact an injury and not COVID-19. UW men's basketball managed to play both of their scheduled games last week.
Oh, Lord. Wait, I have to go to the bathroom. Give me a second here before we get into this. I can't even. I might need a lot of seconds. All right, so I've gotten a stiff drink here. Husky basketball?
Oh, no. Well, you know, men's basketball fell victim to a home upset on Wednesday against Montana 66-58. The Grizzlies' first win over a major conference school since 2017. First over a Pac-12 team since 2010, and their first against UW since 1994. Montana led big early, then pulled away late after the Huskies got back into it. UW shot 2 of 12 on threes in the loss and committed 16 turnovers. It was a tough night for star guard Quade Green, who shot 1 of 11 from the field.
Cool.
And then, despite elevating Nate Pryor and Raekwon Battle to the starting five on Sunday, replacing the struggling Jamal Bey and Eric Stevenson, the Huskies weren't any better Sunday in Las Vegas in non-conference game against Colorado, losing 92-69. UW fell behind 25-7 after 10 minutes and never really got much closer in that one. This loss was more about the defense, which gave up 26 free throws, but the offense struggled too. Riley Sorn, backup center, was a bright spot in both games. 10 points in 10 minutes against Montana off the bench, and then 16 points in 19 minutes on 7 of 8 shooting against Colorado.
Cool.
Sorn, now shooting 76% from the field this season, has grabbed 1 in 5 in available and offensive rebounds while blocking 1 in 10 opponent two-point attempts. He's been the Huskies' best player at this point, I think you have to say.
This is literally the first I've heard of this person.
I have to have mentioned him at some point on the podcast, right?
Wow. Your faith in me listening to you is far too high.
So
Riley Sorn, where did they come from?
Richland. Same as the famous Cousin Katie.
Hello. What high school? Hanford? Are we talking Hanford?
No, not Hanford, but the actual Richland High School. He's 7'4". He originally came to UW as a walk-on and has since earned a scholarship. And
he's the best player on the UW basketball team.
He is. I have a hard-earned skepticism.
He is.
I have a hard-earned skepticism of college players taller than 7 foot, and particularly like guys who are projects who come in at that height. Like back to the Joe Wolfinger days, probably even well before that, because usually those guys are almost always terrible. But Riley Sorn has turned out to be shockingly good for a walk-on who is 7'4", a former walk-on. So that's
fun
something.
Here. Fun here. I mean, we always have to start at the point of they shouldn't be playing these games at all. And what does it matter? Because that's the thing is, like, you know, if we're getting so worked up about any of this, ultimately, who cares? But it's not great. And if you're going to be playing the games, you should at least try to win the games.
I think they are trying. They're just not succeeding a lot because there's just not
we
that
went
much
into the
talent
season,
on this team.
Though, and we looked at it and we said they were pretty devoid of talent. You know, it would have taken a massive, really upgrade by Quade Green, who I think probably has it in him if there's talent around him. But
and he's done it at times. I mean, he did against Seattle U and against Oregon, which is part of why the Huskies played so well in those games.
Without that, you just look around the roster and it's like who. Who's going to do this? Is it going to be the walk-on center from Richland? You know, is it going to be the transfer from Wichita? Like, there's just not a lot of talent. Or is it going to be the players who didn't play well last year, but hey, maybe they'll be good this year? There's not a lot of talent on the team top to bottom.
Which is a tough state to be in, I would say, especially because next year's recruiting class does not look like the salvation.
I feel bad though, because these are young kids who are going to school, and you know, it's not about the individual athletes. I don't think that they're doing anything wrong. They just they don't have the level of talent in general as a program as one would like to see from the University of Washington.
Yep. I mean, guys are being asked to do more than they should. It's quite simple. So now, in worse news, UW football.
Oh, no. We're not moving on that quickly.
Oh.
because look, this is the grievances episode of the Pelton Cast, and December 23rd is not far from now. And I think we have to take a cold, hard look in the mirror at ourselves and say, has the Mike Hopkins era been worth it? And I think that the answer is pretty definitive no. And to really say what is different in this time period than was different under Lorenzo Romar, I got to say these teams look awfully similar. And the one thing about Lorenzo Romar is he led this team to a number one seed. He led this team to the Sweet 16 multiple times. He oversaw the greatest moments in the program history, and he was callously fired. And he was fired at a time period when, the program was a little bit down, but there was an excellent recruiting class coming. And you know what happened to that recruiting class when he was let go? They all left.
Well, Jalen Noel did stay. And Nate Pryor eventually came back.
Oh, hello. We got Nate Pryor. Michael Porter Jr. left, right? Like, Jontay Porter left. This team looked ultimately very different than it. He didn't get to oversee the recruiting class that he had been working on for years and went to Pepperdine and seen a little bit of success at Pepperdine. And
if those two teams played in a neutral floor right now, Pepperdine would be favored.
The reality of what it means to coach and recruit in the Pac-12 in Seattle, Washington, has become very apparent for Mike Hopkins. And Mike Hopkins has legitimately failed basically every single test with recruiting in Seattle. And, we've let five-star recruits go that, if we're being honest, I think Lorenzo probably could have gone out and gotten, or at the very least would have been very competitive with. The one thing that Lorenzo, actually, I'm not going to say the one thing, because he was great at a lot of things. Look, it's Lorenzo fucking Romar here, right? Like, we should always put some respect on his name because he oversaw the greatest time period in Husky basketball program history. He's the person who coached every single one of our favorite Husky basketball players. But aside from Dion Shuttenlund, of course.
The disrespected Donald Watts. After Slick Watts came up earlier on this pod. And Todd McCullough, for that matter.
But he was so good at connecting with athletes in the city of Seattle and bringing them into the UW program. Star players, five-star recruits. And that's what Lorenzo Romar was very, very good at, saying, I'm going to take what you do, put you into the NBA. Has Mike Hopkins been subject to the same issues that Lorenzo Romar was subject to as well? To players going out maybe a little bit sooner than they should have been? Right? Like, I don't think we're going to this year saying to ourselves that they're going to be massive contributors in the NBA as far as
that's everyone now. I don't think you can say that, but I'm saying that
everybody is subject to the same things. Lorenzo Romar was able to recruit. He was able to build. He had a couple of lost recruiting classes and he was gone.
People took what Lorenzo Romar did for granted.
And it's the same fucking thing we're talking about with Pete Carroll. Look, I hate to be a Pete Carroll defender, but like, We have it good, people. Like, when you have it good, don't complain that you could have it better.
I mean, as you pointed out at the start of this, the frustrating thing is, like, that Montana loss was straight out of the Lorenzo Romar playbook in terms of, like, everything that frustrated people about Lorenzo Romar, like losing at home to a non-power team.
They always had a great player on those teams. Every single one that Lorenzo Romar lost to, you'd hear about it, and you'd be like, yeah, that dude's in the NBA now.
Nate
Walters,
always
one player.
Jameel Warney. Jameel Warney never quite caught on in the NBA. He should have, though. He had great stats. He was a 6'5 power forward, so obviously I loved him. That's a great callback. I think he's a little tall. He's like
it's Pac-12 basketball in general too, though. Like,
Pac-12 basketball has been a little better this year.
Has it?
It has. It's been legitimately competitive.
Sustained success has not existed. We talked about this with football, and it's like, I'm on one. Okay, we talked about this with football, where it's like, oh, people just don't care about football on the West Coast, and it's like, I don't know if I fully agree with that, but okay, I can accept this as an idea. But do people not care about basketball on the West Coast either? Because what do we care about?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. The Pac-12 is really awesome at women's basketball, softball, volleyball, All of those. I'm a crew, I'm sure. No, there are other sports I'm not thinking of. Maybe gymnastics. I know that, you know, the UCLA program is really good.
Why
got those
is
on
it,
lock.
Why is it that the Pac-12 cannot compete at basketball and football nationally?
I do think that it's not that people don't care about basketball, but people don't care about college sports in the same way on the West Coast. Let's put it this way. The Pac-12's motto, it's going to be the Conference of Champions. It's not going to be here. It just means more.
But that's about football. Like, nobody is talking about the Alabama basketball team. Nobody's talking about the Auburn basketball team, right?
But they are talking about the Kentucky basketball team. It's not necessarily the same programs, but it is programs in those conferences. And there's no one at that level in the Pac-12. I mean, UCLA was during the Wooden era, but UCLA doesn't mean that much in LA now.
Okay.
USC football is the only sport that is really, and like Oregon Athletic Department, I think, does mean that much in the state of Oregon.
So is your perspective that we just have too much going on? These cities have too many sports.
And the other thing is, these are cities that are much more built on transplants. Like, especially Seattle, compared to 20 years ago, it's a much more transient city. And those people might have a relationship with the Seahawks, but they're not going to have a relationship with UW Athletics.
Why do you have a relationship with the Seahawks then?
Because it's easier
because
to jump
the Seahawks
on that
have
bandwagon.
Won. That's it.
That's part of it. But also, like, everyone who grows up in Seattle grows up a Seahawks fan. Not everyone who grows up in Seattle grows up a Huskies fan. You could be a Coug. You could be a fan of some other college that your parents went to. Like, it's not the same one-to-one relationship.
I think the success is a big part of it, though.
Sure, but UW football has been extremely good in the past, you know, since the year before Chris Peterson got here, since the Pelton Cast started.
It's not two decades.
Sure, but Seahawks were very popular before it was two decades, too. Like, it was basically 2005 that this really started for the Seahawks. And by 2013, the bandwagon was fucking full. And so it's been as long for UW football as it has been for the Seahawks. They haven't won a national championship necessarily. So that maybe they haven't gotten to that level. But even if they did, it would not mean as much to the city of Seattle as it would if the Seahawks won.
I can hear that though. You're saying that in Tuscaloosa, right? In Lexington, in those places.
Those are the only show in town.
This is the only game. And it's Seattle.
It gets back to the NBA argument. Like, it's the difference between the Kings and the Bucks, or the Kings and the Timberwolves, I guess, let's say.
You could own it, but you don't get the TV money quite the same. I can understand that. And
but
I think
can I mount a defense of Mike Hopkins here? The man was coach of the year in the Pac-12 twice. Like, he's not terrible, but I don't
think Mike Hopkins is terrible. It's more like, I think that
all coaches
exist on the same continuum. It's just like, it really is about the talent. I think that coaching is probably overrated. And it's more that I really loved Lorenzo Romar as a coach, and it's frustrating to see him go. Not that we don't like Mike Hopkins. I don't think Mike Hopkins is a bad coach. He just doesn't have talent, and there were years that Lorenzo Romar didn't have talent. And ultimately,
And Lorenzo Romar didn't get a pass for those in the way that Mike Hopkins is currently getting a pass for this, maybe because of the fact that no one cares.
You told me earlier today that the Huskies lost to Colorado by 30 points or whatever, and I was like, wow, no shit, huh?
Oh, we're gonna have
so
to come
they
up with
played
some,
a game.
We're gonna have to come up with some interesting segments for the pod in February and March because
I'll probably pay a little bit more attention in January, February because there's not as much else going on. Or maybe I won't. I don't know. I can't guarantee it.
You should watch my 10 players to watch instead.
I would much rather. Look, I'll have NBA basketball on. Maybe I'll fucking get League Pass this year. Is it cheaper?
No, I don't think they've changed the price.
How much is League Pass?
I want to say $150 off the top of my head.
It's really not that much money. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm going to be watching a lot of Blazers, though.
Our Blazers. So the UW football. UW announced last Friday that it will not seek a bowl berth due to return to play protocols for the number of infected players In sum, it appears that the number of positive tests on the offensive line would have made it impossible for the team to practice ahead of a bowl game, which would have taken place next week, because that's when the bowl season is now. There's a bowl game tomorrow, I think.
There was a bowl game today. Yeah. Appalachian State won a bowl game today. Tomorrow, all these bowl games are fighting over what to name their bowl now that they've moved it to Texas, to Florida, to Alabama, right? Like, it's just like they should just rename it the Shitty Governor Bowls, because that's all that these are, right? That we don't care about COVID bowls. Every single one. Like, there's a bowl game coming up, the Boca Raton Bowl or whatever. It's just like, yeah, slow clap for you all. I hope you're happy, Rose Bowl. I hope you're fucking happy that you're moving this game to Texas so you can have fans, so that if there is a death associated with the Rose Bowl.
I don't think that was the Rose Bowl's call. I think that's the college football playoffs call.
I hope that they're happy too. I hope that every single person involved appreciates what they have done here, exposing people to a deadly virus so that they can go to attend a goddamn college football game by people that have nothing to do with the state of California. I'm like so definitively on the side of the state of California. It is like, it's the biggest FU to the Rose Bowl. They should just fucking be done forever. We have got to stop this. What we're doing here, being involved in a system with all of these programs together, these values are not the same. We're playing the same sport on the field, but we are not playing the same sport anywhere else.
I don't know. I think people in California are plenty happy not playing college, paying college athletes. I mean, obviously not the state. That's not
the piece that I'm talking about. Look, there's a whole other layer to it. There's two different layers. It is layer number one, we're fans in attendance in Australia, where they've essentially quashed the virus, in Russia, and in fucking Texas and SEC country. Hope
Texas,
you're proud.
Texas is SEC country. Texas A&M is in the SEC. So we got a sense of the scale.
If you ask Jimbo Fisher. They're still in the Big 12 if you ask Jimbo Fisher, as far as the respect they get.
We get a sense of the scale of UW's outbreak on Wednesday when UW Athletics announced 25 active COVID-19 cases across all sports.
Why? Why did they play these games? What are these 25 cases? Am
you
I
know
too...
why they played these games, but up
why,
from 14
though? Tell
the previous
me. Week. Tell me why.
It's a thing called money that exists in our society, and because of the fact that we have decided to just continue. I mean, I guess there was a stimulus bill finally, but have
Hello,
generally decided
$600.
To continue status quo. Then these things happen.
The whole thing, that outbreak that happened on the UW team, when you take a step back and look at what it was for, to play four games of a cursed Pac-12 season that ultimately led to no bowl game, to winning the Pac-12 North and not being able to play in the Pac-12 championship. People could have seen this. This wasn't a scenario where it snuck up on us.
Again, I think that it was reasonable for the Pac-12 to think that their level of testing would have mitigated the spread.
Yeah, if you ignored how the virus was spread, it would have been really reasonable to have assumed that.
I mean, clearly in hindsight, the fact that the testing of the rapid testing was done only on symptomatic people and not on asymptomatic people, whereas you knew that there was going to be asymptomatic players who were going to, in fact, have the virus, that was probably what should have been a bigger red flag in hindsight. But you agreed on this podcast that the Pac-12's plan seemed like a reasonable enough thing for them to start the season. So for you to say that now that it was obvious would be hypocritical.
There was a point that it became very apparent, and that point happened before they even started playing football games. The Huskies had their first football game of the season canceled. It's
but
not
they,
like it was week
no,
six.
No, because they had that game canceled because of contact tracing. There was not an outbreak, as far as we know, at Cal. There was an individual player in close contacts who were quarantined. Now, Arizona State and Utah would be a different story because those were legitimate outbreaks.
I think that we learned this early on, that it wasn't safe to play these games, and nobody adjusted. And what that has ended up being is an embarrassing season for the Pac-12.
UW quarterback Jacob Sermon announced his transfer to Central Michigan, where he'll play for former Florida coach Jim McElwain, with one-time Seahawks quarterback Charlie Fry as his offensive coordinator and quarterback coach. Sermon, the 2019 backup quarterback, lost the battle for the starting job to the younger Dylan Morris, and opportunities for advancement limited with the arrival of top-rated recruit Sam Heward as part of the upcoming recruiting class. Based on that, it wouldn't be shocking if we also saw Ethan Garber's transfer. It's kind of just how it works at quarterback. Senior wide receiver Jordan Chin also entered his name in the transfer portal. And by the way, this is my grievance. Why do like college sports writers always say they placed themselves in the transfer portal? The transfer portal is not like something off Star Trek where you immediately go from Seattle to, I don't know what city Central Michigan is in. Ypsilanti is Eastern Michigan. I know that one. You don't directly go there. You still have to travel there like normal human beings. It's not even a portal. It's just a database. That's all it is. Like, I don't know why we call it the transfer portal. 2021 five-star recruit JT Tuimoloau narrowed his finalists for his commitment to five teams, including UW. The other finalists, Alabama, Ohio State, Oregon, and USC. So that'll be a big one for the Huskies if they could potentially land him.
Can I pre-talk about what we'll say when we don't get him?
Sure.
You know what? It's really important just to be in the mix for players like this for UW. As a program that can't compete. Look, it doesn't mean the same amount here in Seattle that it does at a place like Alabama. Every single player from Alabama goes straight to the NFL. They're going to guaranteed to be in the college football playoff. And I can understand personally why they would make that choice to sign with Alabama. So, but the most important thing for a program like UW is just to be in the mix.
Again, I felt it was the worst week in UW athletic department history. That was my takeaway.
Yeah. Well, I canceled my tickets to UW football. And Katie also, because she pays for the tickets. I'll meet you at Pagliacci after the games, though, because I like that part. I'll be there tailgating, and I will meet you at Pagliacci after the games.
Let's talk about the Seahawks coming off their 2015
win. Let's talk about
win.
What it's like trying to tailgate at UW. Let's talk about what it's like trying to tailgate at Padelford.
I think it's a lot better than it's a lot better than trying to tailgate at a Seahawks game.
Do you remember when we paid the money to go park in that garage at UW and then left, and then they were trying to keep our money and we asked
for
that, it back?
That particular experience was bad, yes.
Top-notch stuff.
At least there were porta potties. A 2015 win for the Seahawks Sunday at Washington football team, and they ground that one out, I would say, literally.
May I offer a take?
Yes.
On a week where we saw the Steelers lose to the 2-10-1 Bengals, where we saw the Rams lose to the 0-13 Jets, can we all just cool the fuck off here? Can we not be mad about beating a division-leading team? What if we went into this game terrified of the Washington professional football team, and then all of a sudden, midway through the game, we didn't beat them by enough? Halfway through that game.
Do I need to release the chats? I know that's not allowed to release the in-game chats, but I recall a certain someone from this podcast being pretty, A, thinking the Seahawks were going to lose, I did too.
Putting yourself on blast. It's nice.
But B, being very critical of the Seahawks offense going, they started out conservative.
I'm just trying to have some perspective here. Because literally the moment that the Seahawks game ended, everything went bad for a contending team throughout the NFL. And you know what? The Seahawks won a road game against a team that was leading their division.
I mean,
can we cool the fuck off? Can we just not expect to win by 2-3 touchdowns every game?
Don't expect to win by 2-3 touchdowns every game.
Do I need to turn this into a grievance?
I don't know if you're capable of that at this point. The Seahawks could have lost that game, which would have been extremely problematic. I have some questions about the game plan, but I also understand why they went the game plan they did, because they were playing Dwayne Haskins, and for three quarters, it looked like, hey, just don't screw up and give up a defensive touchdown was absolutely the right strategy.
So. I mean, I think this was... They won a road game against a pretty good team and a very good defense.
I mean, and the other thing about the NFC East leading, which they're, I guess they still are, yes, is that they're leading because of the time when Alex Smith was starting at quarterback, not because of the time when Dwayne Haskins was at quarterback.
But they also won those games with the time when Alex Smith was starting at quarterback, but also when that defense was playing. And the Seahawks generally neutralized Washington's defense. They didn't play a great offensive game.
Strong.
They did not let Washington's defense dominate that game.
They clearly, you know, they had a strategy. They did not want Washington's pass rush to be a big deal, so they got the ball out extremely quick. According to ESPN stats and info, the 4.6 air yards per attempt for Russell Wilson is lowest since the 2015 season opener, and the third lowest of his entire career.
They definitely want to get the ball out quick, but you know what? Russell Wilson lived to see the next day. And do you know what I care about the most? Russell Wilson living to see the next day. And it's something that other quarterbacks have not done against Washington. And you could have told me that Russell Wilson did not play a snap against Washington, and I would have said, you know what? That's a wise move. You could have been like, you know what? Geno Smith started in the game. Like,
they're going to rest Timmy Saddler for this one?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think that was wise. So... how can you be upset with this? They won the game. They went into a road game and they won. And
are people that upset about it? I follow different people. I don't know.
I'm not saying that there's a general upsetness, but it is like there wasn't the elation that I think there should have been. And I think the Seahawks have won some very impressive road games.
I don't think there should have been elation. I think there should have been like. They did what they should have done. This was the median outcome.
Think
for
about
the Seahawks.
Just looking back on this, you say a 10 a.m. start against an excellent defense, and the Seahawks won it. I don't want to say comfortably,
but against probably the worst quarterback. I guess he's not the worst quarterback at this point because
Roethlisberger. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was gonna say
Carson Wentz.
Yeah. He's not the worst quarterback they've faced this season because Carson Wentz.
Oh, Lord. But no, I actually do think Dwayne Haskins is better than Carson Wentz this year. At least in that game, they both kind of had pretty similar trajectories.
Yes. Wentz's two drives, one of them came earlier than Haskins did.
Look. Dwayne Haskins is not a good quarterback, and the Seahawks, I think, had a relatively good game plan against Dwayne Haskins for most of the game, and that collapsed at the end. But when Pete Carroll tells it, and they had a pretty unlucky turnover, which is true, and if they had one field goal, one touchdown, whatever, game's over. Carlos Hyde catches a third down pass. A lot of little tiny moments in that game before it's actually scary. I don't think this was a game that was closer than it should have been. And it wasn't necessarily closer than it should have been because of things that the Seahawks defense did. And they came out with a W against a probably better than their record Washington team. That's it. Done. Do you know where we were a year ago? I don't want to say today, but pretty close.
Well, we just reached that point earlier with the Giants game. Now, the thing I wanted to say
with
is like
with the Giants game, did we lose to the Arizona Cardinals? Are we signing Marshawn Lynch?
The Giants are way worse than last year's Cardinals. I don't agree with that whatsoever.
Okay, so you think that was the last year's Cardinals moment?
Undoubtedly it was.
Okay.
I mean, yes, it wasn't the same in terms of injuries, so I guess that was a positive. But my takeaway from this past week, you mentioned those two huge upsets for contenders, division leaders at that point in both conferences. And I think part of what happens is when the Seahawks play a game like that, it hits us so much emotionally. But when the Steelers play a game like that, it's not like we feel it emotionally. We're just like, oh yeah, any given Sunday you can lose in the NFL.
Yeah.
So we think that we feel like that only happens to the Seahawks, when actually that happens to everyone. And let's be honest, what happened to the Rams against the Jets was way worse than any Seahawks loss, probably in franchise history. I don't know if they've ever lost as a 17-point favorite.
I mean, it was
because they came back and beat Tampa Bay.
A decade.
They probably almost were a 17-point favorite when they went to overtime against Tampa Bay in like 13, but they came back and won that one.
No, it was a terrible loss. And that's the thing, is like, we always want whatever there's such a grass is greener scenario, right? We look at it and we say, wow, if we just had Sean McVay, how great would things be? If we just had Kyle Shanahan, it's like Kyle Shanahan is not, he's been to a Super Bowl and he's had some pretty bad seasons. He's had nothing but losing seasons otherwise.
Well, those guys have been settled with some pretty awful quarterbacks. Seahawks were only 14.5-point favorites in that game that went to overtime against Tampa Bay. I guess that was untrue.
But you understand what I'm saying here. Like, nothing is perfect. And if you were a fan and paying as close attention to those other teams, you would be just as upset with your coach as we are with Pete Carroll. Like, there are things that are extraordinarily frustrating with Pete Carroll, right?
I feel like I made this argument to you last week about Pete Carroll.
Did you?
That's what I recall.
Oh, yeah. You recall. Perfect argument. It came to fruition. I actually think that I kind of nailed that the game when we were talking about it last week, which I think you were a little bit more negative than I was. And it was just like, it came down to top to bottom, the Seahawks are a better team. And I think that's kind of where it ended up being, was
top, I mean, we also bottom, weren't sure that Dwayne Haskins was going to start.
There's no perfect solution in the NFL. There's no perfect coordinator. There's no perfect coach. That's it. You know, Twitter doesn't get to fucking poll for what every decision, right? Every play call. And there's no perfect scenario. And sometimes coaches who seem like they might be better coaches with the talent that you have lose to the goddamn Jets. And it was a brutal loss for the Rams.
It was, yeah. I mean, it sets up the Seahawks where they can win the division on Sunday night. And there's also, like, that didn't occur to me when I was rooting for the Jets in this entire game, because I never considered the possibility that the Seahawks would beat the Rams. Yeah. It was only the fact that they could lose to the Rams and still win the division. Exactly. If they win in week 17 against San Francisco and Arizona, and if the Cardinals win in LA against the Rams.
And that's an important way to think. But I was watching that Cardinals-Eagles game thinking, like, I was cheering for the Eagles, and I was like, I'm so used to cheering against the Cardinals all season, but if I want a fun playoffs, I should probably want Kyler to be in the playoffs over Mitchell Trubisky or the Vikings, right? Like, I should really actually be cheering for the Cardinals.
Yes, you also want the Cardinals to have a lot to play for in week 17. By the way, the Seahawks loss at home to the Giants, the second largest on record, according to the Pro Football Reference database, in terms of the pregame spread in games they lost. The only bigger upset, Seahawks versus St. Louis in 2015. They were 12-point favorites and lost that 23-17. You'll never guess, but this happened at the end of the season, although it did not ruin a holiday. That was December 27th, 2015.
Seahawks, St. Louis?
Yeah, I don't particularly remember that one myself, actually.
This game did not happen.
I mean, it was like a Cardinals game, except it happened against St. Louis. Jermaine Kearse scored a touchdown at the end of the game to create that final.
What game was this?
End of the 2015 season.
Oh, wait. What was the 15 season?
That was the Russ great season.
And we lost to the Rams to end it?
This would have been right after No, it was week 15. This would have been right after Thomas Rawls was injured. Fred Jackson had the most rushing yards besides Russell Wilson on the team. The leading carries were Bryce Brown.
Wow. I kind of remember Bryce Brown and Fred Jackson. I do remember a time. It's kind of funny when you look back at it, you're like, Fred Jackson's probably 45 years old right now. He's actually like 31. He's not even reached 30. But these things happen. And I think this was an impressive CX victory that they had on Sunday. And the other point to take away from it is nothing about what happened on Sunday, both to the Seahawks and the Rams, will fucking matter for this next Sunday. And the Rams are just as scary of a team as we saw.
I agree with you on the Rams. I don't agree with you on the Seahawks because okay. I think that they will be emboldened by the success of their uber conservative strategy against the Washington defense and try to do something similar against the Rams, probably even better defense.
Okay.
And I think there's a way that can succeed. Like we saw that with that drive that ended in the Russell Wilson interception, where there was a lot of short, quick passes to DK. Those are the kind of plays that are going to be there for you that are not going to put
that
Russ
short of passes to DK.
No,
first downs on
no,
both of them.
I agree. I mean, in terms of air yards, it was probably like 7 or 8, not 4.6. But those are the kind of plays, and maybe they're not going to be there to DK against Jalen Ramsey, but those are the kind of plays that are going to be there, hopefully, to Josh Gordon.
Hello.
I don't know if Pete Carroll was not clear that he was actually going to play this week. He is available to start practicing. He is eligible. He's on the 53-man roster. So that's exciting. He's freed. Other news on the injury front. Sounds like Quentin Dunbar and Trey Flowers might return to practice this week, although they may have a hard time unseating DJ Reed, who Pete Carroll said played as good a game as a corner has played for us in a while against
I actually
Washington.
Legit love DJ Reed.
He's great.
He's played nothing but great games since he's been here, and he's made a lot of plays. Single coverage, you know, I think if we're being honest, that's Quentin Dunbar's job. And if Quentin Dunbar is healthy, he will take that job back. But
Quentin Dunbar is not going to be healthy until the offseason. Pete Carroll's made that pretty clear.
DJ Reed played a great football game against Washington, made a lot of plays in single coverage. And I would be surprised if he wasn't starting on Sunday.
Still no word yet on Brandon Shell, who was unable to get back for last week's game. Cedric Oyelowo, he did a pretty solid job last week, although
thought the blocking in general, both pass blocking and run blocking, was pretty solid.
I mean, the question that we're going to have a better idea of this week is how good is the Seahawks defense? Because they've had this strong stretch of games, you know, a dominating first three quarters against Washington before struggling in the fourth, but they have not played a competent offense for a long period of time. You know, depending on how injured Kyler Murray was in that Cardinals game, maybe since the last game against the Rams.
And the Rams are a team where you look at it that and you see what they did against the Jets, and maybe they didn't look great, but they understand the Seahawks defense better than basically any other team understands the Seahawks defense. And the Rams understand the holes in the Seahawks defense. Jared Goff, Sean McVay, etc., understand the holes in the Seahawks defense better than basically anybody else in the NFL. And that's why they are such a terrifying team to play.
The Seahawks did actually do a decent job defensively in the game at LA. And that's kind of the story of this Rams season, where their defense has been the star much more than their offense. Now, when Goff does play well, they're almost impossible to beat. When he posts a QBR of 50 or better this season, the Rams are 7-1. They're 2-4 when he fails to reach that mark. And since playing the Seahawks, he has been wildly inconsistent. His QBRs in the last five games, 83.5 in the win at Tampa Bay, 11.5 in a loss to San Francisco, 87.8 in a win at Arizona. The one blah performance was a 47.3 in a win over New England. And then yesterday, an 18.8 QBR for Jared Goff in the loss to the Jets.
And if there was ever going to be a week that Jared Goff was going to have a great week, it is this week. I can tell you personally why they lost the two different times they've lost to Seattle in the Sean McVay and Jared Goff era. And that is incomplete pass to Cooper Kupp in the end zone, field goal by Greg Zuerlein. This team is perfect against the Seahawks defense. And
perfect is strong. I mean, the Seahawks defense actually did a pretty solid job against the Rams offense in the previous meeting. I would say it was much more the Rams defense against the Seahawks offense that was the
issue. Also, Aaron Donald's terrifying, but they just, this is not a great matchup, traditionally great matchup for the Seahawks.
No, I certainly wouldn't say it's a great matchup.
Look, Sam Darnold ain't walking through that door. Frank Gore ain't walking through that door.
No, I suppose that none of those things are happening. Dwayne Haskins is not walking through that door, and Peyton Barber is not walking through that door either.
It has been a very tough go of playing the Rams, and whatever the outcome was against the Jets does not, to me, affect whatever is going to happen on Sunday. You know?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, we've seen that with the Seahawks. We've talked about it. Like, they can play a terrible game and then play a perfectly competent game the next week. There's not momentum in the same way that people might think there is. Goff's worst game since 2018 against the Seahawks would be his 8.1 yards per attempt in the loss last season in Seattle. So he has been pretty solidly, you know, above average against the Seahawks.
And they have not been able to figure out pressuring the Rams. And that's the thing that other teams have been able to figure out how to do, and the Seahawks have not. And I think that if there was one negative takeaway from this Washington game is, they really, aside from that last drive, you know, which, beautiful thing to see an LJ Collier sack, and then an even more beautiful thing to see that diving in Carlos Dunlap sack. But they did not get a lot of pressure throughout that game. They, you know, Dwayne Haskins missed a lot of throws, but they did not get a lot of pressure on Dwayne Haskins. And I have to get a lot of credit to Washington and their game plan, but I don't think that we can look at this and say that they're going to neutralize Jared Goff, right? They're not going to force him to have one of his worst games. They never have.
The Seahawks did do a pretty good job on Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods in the last meeting, holding the Rams' top two wide receivers to a combined 83 yards on 13 targets. But number three wide receiver Josh Reynolds had 94 yards on 10 targets. And tight ends Tyler Higbee and Gerald Everett had 87 yards on 9 targets. And we certainly saw covering tight ends be an issue for the Seahawks on Sunday when Logan Thomas had all of the catches.
You know, it's wild. I actually just drafted Logan Thomas for fantasy next year. He's going to be a monster. Logan Thomas is a legit tight end.
Coming off a breakout 29 carries for 171 yard performance against New England, Cam Akers suffered a high ankle sprain on Sunday and is expected out this week. That means the Rams will presumably go back to a timeshare of Daryl Henderson and Malcolm Brown at running back.
There are two running backs that were successful for the entire season before then.
Henderson entered last week number two in rushing DVOA, and Brown also has a better rushing DVOA than Akers.
I think this is a factor. And I do think that the Rams really wanted Cam Akers to seize that job. And I think that Cam Akers has been quite good. But it doesn't fucking matter.
It's a tough call, but I would say that Sunday was actually a more disappointing performance by the Rams defense than their offense. They had moved all the way up to number three in defensive DVOA. But a week after going 14 of 26 for 132 yards against that vaunted Seahawks defense, Sam Darnold had a career high 88.5 QBR on Sunday.
Pretty wild. The Jets did not play as badly against the Seahawks as the 40-3 score would indicate.
Yeah, but there's a lot of room to play poorly and not play that poorly. Darnold sacked just twice last week by a Rams team that is third with 8% of opponent dropbacks and in sacks. They are number one still in yards per attempt at 6.1, number one in yards per completion at 9.7, and number one at net yards per attempt after considering sacks of 5.0 on pass attempts. This is a scary defense.
Mm-hmm. Nothing changes. One loss to the Jets does not change that they're a scary defense.
I mean, this might be obvious since he had two picks against the Seahawks, but even beyond that game, I've been really impressed with Darius Williams in his role opposite Jalen Ramsey, which we know from the Richard Sherman era is not always that easy a position because you tend to get picked on a lot. Williams allowing completions on just 52.5% of his targets per Sport Radar tracking on ProFootballReference.com, only marginally higher than the 51% completion rate Ramsey is allowing, although Ramsey is allowing just 4.8 yards per target. Williams at 6.4 isn't quite that good, and nickel corner Troy Hill's 7.3 and 71% completion rate has been the better target in the Rams secondary.
So is there an opening?
I mean, I don't think that the Seahawks should just completely ignore DK Metcalf if Jalen Ramsey is covering him, but you definitely want to try and engineer scenarios where he's not and try to make plays that way.
Well, and also pretty threateningly, Greg Olsen most likely coming back this week. It's something that, you know, the tight end passing game has definitely been weaker without Greg Olsen, and seeing that he'll return is very important.
Agreed with that. Aaron Donald's 12 sacks tie him for second most in the NFL. He actually did not get one last game against the Seahawks, but the Rams had six as a team, including three by Leonard Floyd, whose 7.5 sacks are a career high.
Still afraid of Aaron Donald, for the record.
Of course, always. Yes. Although the Rams are better against the pass, they also ranked number six in rush defense DVOA entering last week. So not sure the Seahawks will be able to get a lot, whole lot more going on the ground, even with a full complement of healthy veteran running backs, after it was Alex Collins who led the committee in their trip to LA.
Wow, that feels like that was an eternity ago.
Doesn't it?
Alex Collins was their number one running back in LA? Okay, maybe that makes me feel just slightly better.
One huge Rams weakness, their special teams, where they ranked 30th in the NFL in DVOA entering last week. They are below average across the board and particularly bad in place kicking, where Matt Gay, their third kicker this season, looks like he's going to be one to finally stick.
All right. Can you tell me a weather forecast for this game? Because I think that matters.
I can tell you a weather forecast for this game. 45 degrees, partly cloudy, approximately 25% chance of rain.
What was that percent chance again?
About 25%.
It doesn't quite warrant air horn levels of weather, but
I don't know that. Well, let's see. The AM shower is now on Sunday, but it is still, they're no longer showing the partly cloudy, but still about 25% chance of rain around game time.
Let me ask you a question. This is week 16. It's still very late week 16, in fact. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Can this game ruin Christmas?
Not technically, I don't think.
That might warrant an air horn.
Oh, yeah.
This game, have they played almost any week 16 ever post-Christmas? It's been pretty rare.
Well, I just told you about that LA Rams game in 2015. That was a week 16. Or the St. Louis Rams game, I should say, in 2015. That was a Rams game post-Christmas.
Literally nobody remembers that game, though. So
True. I'm sure none of the listeners will have any memory.
It was like that game is wiped from my mind.
We only remember. I mean, it was the one loss in the stretch where they went 6-1 to finish the season. So
we probably rationalized the fuck out of it. But
I'm sure we did. And forgotten when they won the DVOA Bowl against Arizona 36-6 the next week.
Huge DVOA ball game. I look at this game and I don't think there's going to be a Rams game in the McVay Goff era where I'm going to go into it feeling confident. And especially with the stakes of what the Seahawks are facing here, has there been a time that in late December they have played a game with such stakes and won? It's been a while. You know, right? We're talking going back to 2013 or so.
Usually they're not playing the best other team in the NFC West other than last year against San Francisco. Usually it's the Cardinals at home in week 16.
I actually do remember week 17 against San Francisco. And I remember that Jacob Hollister was in and nobody else seems to remember that. But this is the type of game that the Seahawks lose. And they have lost this game over and over and over again for the second era of the Russell Wilson Pete Carroll collaboration. Will this be different? Maybe. Do I have any reason to feel different about it?
No, what about the Kansas City game? Are we counting that because it wasn't a division opponent? But that was on Festivus Sunday Night Football.
Wow, that was December 23rd.
That sure was.
Dang. That was Monday Night Football. Sunday Night Football. God, that game was so good.
Yes.
Oh, man. That's pretty interesting. That's an interesting wrinkle. when it's not the Arizona Cardinals, things are a little bit different.
And it's usually rainy in those situations. Like, it's late December. Typically, it's going to be rainy in Seattle. So if we can get mostly clear conditions, that's going to be a huge win.
Okay, I think you might have swung me about 50% chance of victory here. But it's not far.
What are you going with?
And I think when playing the Rams, a team that has been a foil to the Seahawks for the entire Goff and McVay era, I think it's hard to go past...
Let's just say the entire McVay era, not win the previous Goff era.
Okay. I mean, really, we could even probably stretch as far back as Jeff Fisher, and the results weren't great.
Well, but
I'm going to go 55% chance of victory.
You ended up more optimistic. I'm going to go 50-50. I do think it's a bad matchup. I think the Rams are a slightly better team. Obviously, the Seahawks home field helps even that up.
How much do you think home field matters?
A little. Like, people are making a big deal about
I'm fucking pissed about these people being like, well, home field's out. It's such a take artist fucking thing to say. Being like, well, home field's out. On to the next thing. And it's just like, fuck you, dude. What are the stats for that?
Well, the stats, I mean, the issue is that the stats do show that home field has been pretty irrelevant this season. The last I saw was home teams are winning 52% of the time. Now, the NFL season is a small sample. I do think that home field still matters probably a little bit more than that. It's maybe like 55% home field is the true home field. And then I would subtract like 5% from the Rams being a better team. And that's how I get it 50-50.
I mean, if we're being honest, sure, 50%. But I feel a little bit more confident about this. I think the Seahawks are legitimately a better team than the Rams are. Maybe top to bottom, they're not a better team in the same way that we looked at this game against Washington, where you could say, you know, they have probably better players in almost every position group than Washington. I don't think that's the case with the Rams. But if we're judging teams overall, quarterback is a very important position. And
yes,
Russell Wilson is still the quarterback of the Seattle Seahawks, and Jared Goff is still the Seahawks of the LA Rams, or is still the quarterback of the LA Rams.
And in some ways, he is the Seahawks of the LA Rams. I agree.
One might call him the Pete Carroll of the LA Rams. but I think that because of those factors and playing the game at home, the Seahawks have to be a slight edge here. We've seen disappointment in this type of game so many times, and I don't think that we'll be shocked by disappointment, but does it warrant the 55%? I think so in this one. Am I terrified of the Rams? Of course I am. No question. Can you tell us a little bit about what this game means within the scheme of the NFC?
Well, in terms of finishing second or third?
The conference or the division and placement within the conference.
Well, as I said earlier, if the Seahawks win, they win the NFC West. If the Rams win, they still need to win or have a Seahawks loss in week 17 to clinch the division. That's the meaning of the Jets game. One of the things I brought up on Twitter is a lot of people are saying, well, I'd rather be the number 5 seed and play at Washington again than be the number 3 seed and play at home. But the problem with that logic is Tampa Bay wins a head-to-head tie with the Seahawks, as far as I can tell, based on common opponents. So if the Buccaneers were to win out and they've got two favorable matchups, they've got, I think, home for Atlanta in week 17, and next week they're facing Detroit, probably at Detroit, they should win both of those games. If they do, they are the 5 seed. The Seahawks can't be the 5 seed. They can only be the 6 seed or the 3 seed, which would mean you're almost certainly playing the Rams either way. And it's just determining the outcome of who wins the NFC West just determines whether you play that game in LA or Seattle.
So there's an extraordinarily likely game that this is a repeat of a playoff game.
We're probably going to see these two teams play 3 times, yes.
Fucking shit.
Which is weird that it hasn't happened, because they both have made the playoffs a lot lately.
It's,
I guess that's
that
not
I'm
actually
somehow
true.
Blaming you for this.
I did not come up with the strength of record tiebreaker.
Ah, oh, God.
I forget who it is the Seahawks lost to. I think it's the Giants. Are the Giants the strength of record tiebreaker?
Oh, that's cool, because I'm definitely over that loss.
One fun reason, the loss to the Giants will haunt the Seahawks. It is the Giants, yes.
Are you kidding me?
The common opponents...
At Detroit and hosting Atlanta is not an easy slate of games. They're not guaranteed victories, either of them, for Tampa Bay.
Look, we already talked about how any given Sunday, teams get upset.
But even then, they're not... There's a possibility for the other those games.
I mean, go Daryl Bevel. The common opponents are the Giants, the Rams, who the Buccaneers lost to, and then the Falcons, who the Seahawks beat twice, but obviously if the tiebreaker comes once. Into play...
Only played the Falcons once.
The Falcons, the Seahawks beat once. Tampa Bay, if these teams both win out, would have beaten twice, by definition, is what I was trying to say there. So they would be 3-1 against those opponents. The Seahawks would be 2-2. So
cool. Really love that Giants game. Really love the impact that's going to have long term.
Well, I mean, if the Seahawks win the NFC West, it still might determine 2-3. So, yeah. What I'm saying is the Giants game is going to ruin Christmas, even though it happened well before Christmas.
That's the kind of energy that I'm about.
There it is. We found it. We found it.
Happy Festivus, everybody. That game is, what was the final score? 17-12, New York Giants. Colt McCoy is the victor. I hope that you appreciate your Festivus this year.
Well, we seriously do hope everyone has a happy holidays, Festivus, Christmas, whatever else you celebrate. If it's Hanukkah in the rearview mirror now. And look forward to talking to you next week when hopefully we're going to be talking about the NFC West champions.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
But you make me sing like a guitar humming. It's the best song ever recorded. Should have been my entire top 10.
Have you ever heard Santa Claus is Coming to Town? Performed by Bruce Springsteen.
How you doing out there?
What time is it? Oh, Christmas time.
He seems genuinely surprised.
I had no idea. It's weird that we started to play this song.
Christmas time.